Did you know that the germs can come through the wires? I never call and I never answer. It's a good way to get sick. Very, very sick. That's how I got so sick. Someone called me on the telephone!
Hiroshima.
That was excellent.
Okay.
Sound very much like
I have goosebumps.
Norman Bates' mother.
But that might be because it's 40 degrees. In
Norman? Who's that girl you're talking to, Norman?
Norman Bates' mother.
No one, mother.
All the sequel.
She's a whore!
Yeah, sequels.
I'm way too loud, Lucas.
Yeah, well, you're also screaming.
You're peeking. It's
an old lady.
I know.
It's an old lady!
All right.
Peking duck!
Hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to another exciting episode of Know Your Turns at the Drive-In, the show where we discuss the strange, the obscure, the B, the cult, the classic, or sometimes just plain bad movies.
Hi. Oh, if you're a fan and you want to help spread the message.
Someday.
Okay. So,
somehow.
All right, no, all right,
somewhere.
Hold on. I got it. If you enjoyed this show, may we suggest you also find us on... fuck.
If you enjoy this show, first of all, they haven't heard it yet.
Hey!
You know what to say.
I know what to say.
It's never happened to you.
I'm trying to...
Oh, no, this happens every time. Yes, I edited it out.
All right.
But not anymore. It's just too good.
All right, so...
Yeah, keep it.
Welcome to listening to the... Thank you for listening to this show. May I suggest you find this and other podcasts at psychojellyfish.com. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and the podcast app Stitcher. Please rate and review. It really does help the show. And if you want to help spread our madness, give us a like at facebook.com/psychojellyfish. Or follow us at Jellycast on Twitter.
By George, I think he's got it. I'm David Halstead, and here is my co-host,
Lucas Wilson.
And we are here with two, not one, but two special guests. I don't know why I keep going into like the...
Michael Buffer?
Yeah. I swear. But two special guests, they've both been on the show separately, but we've never had them both in this room together. This is a historic moment. I think they might take over the show and replace us and maybe bury us in the backyard.
We'll throw you in a couch.
So
throw you in a couch and leave you in the middle of Canada.
Please introduce yourselves, the new hosts of Know Your Turn at the Drive-In.
I am Evan Jones.
And I am Dominic, and sometimes I am, what's her name?
Dominique and Danielle.
No, it's Matt Allegretti.
Don't turn her away from the microphone when you're talking.
Don't be ashamed of your name.
I'm ashamed of my name. I'm ashamed to be here, but no. All right, let's go.
And tonight we are all gathered around a little campfire. It's very little. It's actually just two matches. We don't want to set off any alarms. But we are gathered here to talk about Brian De Palma's 1973 movie, Sisters.
Hood.
Sister Act? Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you mean with Tina Fey?
Traveling Pants?
All right, take
so,
two.
Yes, Sisters.
Sisters. They were once one in body, and perhaps one in mind. Danielle and Dominique. One loving, one hating. One innocent, the other... Where does Danielle end and Dominique begin?
Stop!
Remember...
She's a freak! Freak! She's a freak! 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 Freak!
What the devil hath joined together, let no man cut asunder.
Why are we talking about this movie, Sisters? Because it was brought up by you two, actually.
Yeah, you two were just patting each other on the back, going, Sisters, Sisters.
Yes.
Pat, 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 Sisters.
It's all Evan.
I recently made a top 10 list of my favorite directors that I was posting onto Facebook, and Brian De Palma is, I think he came in at number 4, maybe. And I just absolutely love Brian De Palma. I love his movies. They're not all great, but that's part of the reason why I love them. They're so stylistic. And you can read my review or my critique of him on Facebook, or I'm sure it'll be posted on the Psycho Jellyfish
friends of yours to read him,
website soon.
Yeah, hopefully. Get to on that, Evan.
But for each director, I chose a clip from a movie that I liked. And for Brian De Palma, I chose a clip from Sisters, one of the more kind of radical and weird clips from the movie.
Which one was it?
Was it the dream sequence?
It was the dream. Oh. The dream sequence near the end. And with that like crazy German doctor, you know, who the stereotypical evil German scientist doctor guy. And it really caught the attention of Matt in particular, who then went out and found every Brian De Palma movie he could get his hands on and watched them all within the last week.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what happened. When I was 15, I had seen, like, Scarface, and, you know, I was like any teenager watching Scarface thinking it was amazing. But I had, and I'd seen Casualties of War because of Tarantino and a few others, but I had always felt that that was kind of a hole in my film knowledge, my directors. I had not seen many of his films. So when Evan mentioned him and put him at number four, I was like, this is way too high for probably De Palma, but, I started watching. Actually, Sisters was the first one I saw. So, and I was just kind of blown away by how he took Hitchcock and kind of made it his own. And kind of, we kind of talked about this earlier, but like, I mean, brought in the more sleazy elements and almost made it into it's like an exploitation film in a lot of ways. Yeah. And
was saying Hitchcock is perverse, whereas De Palma is sleazy.
Yes, very much so.
Yes, but beautifully done and stylistically. I mean, he's just
beautiful.
Every
sleazy
shot. I mean, for him, the camera, he said this, I mean, the camera, the placement of the camera is just as important as the actual subject matter. And I think that comes through in a lot of his films. Yeah.
Hitchcock felt the same way about camera. He said camera is absolutely the most, because that's what the audience sees, you know? It's all they know is what they see through the lens of the camera, so that is everything.
I like the split screen thing.
Oh, that's...
That he did in that.
Brian De Palma is the best at split screen. Sisters in particular has what I consider the
best.
Like
even when the people are in the same room, it's like the reverse shot. Well, like you got the shot reverse shot without having a cut between them because they're happening at the same time.
Brian De Palma uses a split screen better than anyone, and Sisters is his best usage of the split screen. He has multiple movies that utilize split screen, but the one in Sisters where it's one hallway and one guy's walking one way and one guy's walking the other way, and then they eventually pass and then the guys are on the opposite screen that they were on. It's just like, it sounds simple, but it's not. And it's so good. And it's so effective.
And you get the moments where, say, like in one screen, like separate things are happening on the other screen, but it's like kind of heightening the tension because what's happening on that screen is about to converge with the other one. Right. And it's like, we got to hide what's happening here because the police over here are coming. It's like
his most recent film, Passion, had a pretty long split screen scene where one half was like a murder scene or like the about to murder someone, and the other half was a ballet performance with the ballerina staring straight into camera the whole time doing her routine, and the other side someone's prepping to get murdered or prepping to murder someone, and then someone gets murdered and then it goes right back into the murder.
Oh,
I can't wait to watch that. I have that. But I also think that what he did was he found, in this movie in particular, you know, he loves Hitchcock, obviously, and he wanted to kills off Philip 30 minutes into the movie in a way, and it's similar to the way that Janet Leigh was replaced by Vera Miles, but he uses a split screen to pass the torch from Philip to the Grace Collier, the journalist. And does it in a way where he's reaching out, you know, he's bleeding to death and reaching out his hand on the window.
Yeah.
And then you see her watching it. And now the rest of the movie is going to mostly be through her point of view.
So that's
a switch.
That is Psycho reference and Rear Window reference in one shot.
Oh, yeah.
And then using the split screen in a way that hadn't really been done up to that time. And I mean, he's the most effective in the history of film, probably. For
one of his earlier films, Dionysus in 69.
Can you find that? I
think it's on YouTube, actually.
Okay, yeah.
The whole thing is filmed split screen. The entire hour and a half long. It's like a filmed performance, kind of. So it's very stagey. But the whole thing is filmed in split screen. And it's like engaging. And it's not distracting at all. Mm-hmm. It's well done.
Right. And you're seeing these two things happening at the same time. And they're going to come together. And where most films, they cut between them and they tell you, this is getting closer, but you don't really have that feeling because these cuts are interruptions. And when you cut from one, the other stops existing in your mind a little bit. Yeah. And even
like, they almost make the other stop existing because, like, you'll cut to one, and then when you cut back, it's, like, right where you left off, like, no time has passed.
In Phantom of the Paradise, yeah, there's a split-screen scene that's kind of an homage to Orson Welles' Touch of Evil with the bomb in the back of the car at the beginning of Touch of Evil, that long 8-minute shot, opening shot. In Phantom of the Paradise, we see the bomb go into a car, and then the car is on one half of the screen, and the other half is the performance that's happening on screen. Phantom of the Paradise is like a music movie.
Horror musical,
yeah. So the car is always in view, reminding you that this thing's going to blow up whenever it feels like it, you know? And meanwhile, this performance is happening in front of the car, so that goes back to the Alfred Hitchcock, let the audience know, so then they'll be held in suspense the whole time, rather than just blow up a car, which doesn't hold anyone in suspense.
And of course, in Carrie, he also uses it in the prom scene effectively, and I think Blowout, he uses it also. Most of his films, I think, most of the De Palma films, I mean, I don't know about the Hollywood films, and I haven't watched a lot of those in a while. I mean, I remember seeing Untouchables and thinking it was a really good movie.
That's something we should touch upon.
Ooh. Yeah, right.
Brian De Palma
You're going to touch upon Untouchables.
All right, that's interesting. Brian De Palma has kind of two career paths. He has the Hollywood Brian De Palma, and he has the Brian De Palma, which is what I call it, which the Hollywood Brian De Palma is the movies most people have seen. The first Mission Impossible movie, Scarface, Untouchables, Bonfire Carlito's the Way. Vanities, Carlito's Way, like kind of studio Hollywood mainstream films.
Mission to Mars,
The Black Dahlia, movies that got a decent budget and people know he's a good filmmaker, so they give him these kind of substantial movies with lead actor, like A-list actors in it, you know, Sean Connery, Robert De Niro, Sean Penn, Al Pacino, these guys. But then there's the Brian De Palma movies that Brian De Palma writes, directs, edits, and his kind of passion projects, which is Passion, his most recent movie. Sisters is certainly one of them.
Blowout. Dress to Kill.
Body Double.
Yeah. And, pretty much all the ones we're talking about.
Yeah, those are the really fun ones.
Yeah.
Raising Kane, which I know Matt hasn't seen yet, but it's
on the list. Oh, and Femme Fatale.
Femme Fatale. Underrated.
Raising Kane just released on Blu-ray recently.
Yeah. It's coming out in Shout Factory, too.
There's an alternate cut someone made of Raising Kane because Brian De Palma, I guess, when he was editing his version of Raising Kane, it just wasn't working for him. So he kind of re-edited the first half of the movie to make it more like mainstream friendly, because in the alternate cut it takes like half an hour before there's any like quote action, like before there's a murder. So when he edited it for the actual release, like opening 10 minutes someone's dead, then it kind of, you know, they give you that at the beginning and then it kind of takes its time after that, whereas before it was more of like the Hitchcockian approach of let's establish these characters and let's get to know these guys and then boom, we'll smack them with a murder half
like
an hour in.
Philip dying in Sisters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian De Palma is utilized as a filmmaker a lot to make these kind of big budget movies, but we all know what he loves to do, and that's really just creep everyone out and be sleazy.
There is a sort of like a feeling a little dirty after you, a little unclean, I need a shower maybe.
And I'll say that even in his Hollywood films, you see little touches of his sleaziness happening.
Like, Black Dahlia, definitely.
Yeah, certainly Black Dahlia, but...
I was going to say Scarface, the chainsaw shower.
The chainsaw shower.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm here watching this gangster film. I'd seen the original Scarface, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I was just like, what the shit is going on? Where did this go? And from that moment on, I was just held on the edge of my seat.
Yeah.
I was like, any fucking thing is going to happen.
Untouchables, which is probably his most like straightforward, you know, by the book movie.
It was like a kind of movie I'd watch with my dad, you know.
The spoiler alert, the scene leading up to Sean Connery's character's demise is all first person point of view shot of someone like breaking into Sean Connery's house, kind of following where he's going. Brian De Palma uses first person perspective a lot in his camera, where you see the hand coming in to open the door.
Yep.
and the
Argento
hand is
style
behind.
Or something.
Yeah. That whole scene in The Untouchables, which is a very straightforward by the book movie, you know, even that's got De Palma, the long shot, the long Steadicam shot with the first person point of view with like a knife in front of you. Blowout also does the same technique at the very beginning.
Two directors, I guess, co-directors, you would say, who started out with very like Hitchcock influence, but then they went. It was the Coen Brothers with Blood Simple.
Blood Simple, yeah.
Blood Simple, yeah.
And it's like you think of like Brian De Palma's early films, but Brian De Palma kind of stayed in that, whereas like the Coen Brothers moved on into other.
Yeah,
interests.
Their next film is Raising Arizona, which is a little sillier than Blood Simple. Tarantino has been hugely influenced by Brian De Palma's movies, and Tarantino. You know, he's been a major proponent for De Palma's work.
Yeah.
De Palma, I feel like, gets flack for being like kind of a B movie director, I guess.
A cult movie, I would say. More
cult
than
movie.
B.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Tarantino absolutely loves his work.
Pauline Kael really loved him, too.
Could you cite a Tarantino reference to De Palma?
The Kill Bill, for sure, when she's in the hospital.
Yeah.
And the whistling down the hallway that I can't think of her name, the girl with the eye patch, you know, that whole thing. Is pure De Palma. I think there's a little split
that's
screen.
Bernard
in there
Herman,
too.
Yeah, that's his music.
Bernard Herman music, which De Palma used a few times.
There's split screen in Kill Bill. There's split screen in
that was Daryl Hannah, the girl.
Daryl Hannah, thank you.
I think True Romance might have direct references to.
Oh yes, I always forget that because he didn't direct that.
That's a Tony Scott film.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Script was at Tarantino.
And that, I mean, Grindhouse the.
Grindhouse, especially.
The first part, the Nightmare. I can't.
Planet Terror
has a direct De Palma reference when one of the zombies is about to saw off Josh Brolin's face, but then it cuts to like the plug in the wall, and right as soon as it gets to his face, it unplugs and the power dies.
Body double.
Yeah,
right?
body double.
With the drill.
They do that. Yeah, there's a big drill in body double that might be used to
such an awesome scene
to kill someone.
Yeah. So we mentioned that Bernard Herrmann did the score to this.
I'm very tempted to buy this score very soon.
Yeah. I think they
I bought it and it's well worth it.
Yeah. Such a weird one.
There's a funny story about when De Palma showed this movie to Bernard Herrmann. This was his first time working with Bernard Herrmann. Bernard Herrmann, for anyone who doesn't know, was Hitchcock's
go-to
film score. He also did the score for Citizen Kane, and he did tremendous work. Go YouTube everything he's done right
now. He's like the original
best
great
film
composer.
Yeah, the studio, the studios for of the studio system.
Certainly, and he was legendary by the time Sisters had come out, and he was near the end of his life, so he was kind of an old crotchety man, Bernard Herrmann. So De Palma, when he had his edit of Sisters, and he had no music, so he used tracks that Bernard Herrmann had used from old Hitchcock movies. So, like during the murder, you might the psycho score might have kicked in, or the theme from Marnie kicked in. So they started watching it, and Bernard Herrmann told him to shut this movie off. And De Palma was like, "Why? What's wrong?" He's like, "I can't watch your movie while listening to Marnie. Like, it's gonna ruin any creative influence I have. So I need the music gone. I want to watch the film as you did it." And another thing, De Palma said Herrmann really helped him make Sisters. Because Herrmann had great film knowledge and knew what worked for the psychology of the viewer. And there was one scene in Sisters in the edit before it was released where very long stretch of time where kind of not much was happening. And Bernard Herrmann was like, you have to cut this down or you have to trim it. It's just too long. And Brian De Palma said something to the effect of, well, this is what Hitchcock would have done. And Bernard Herrmann goes, yeah, you're not Hitchcock.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice!
I just was reading that in the Brian De Palma interviews. The original idea was just to have Danielle undressing over white credits. And Bernard Herrmann said, that's wrong. And, you know, you can't do that, basically. And like Evan said, it's basically because he said, they'll wait for Hitchcock. They're not going to wait for you.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he probably came up with that Peeping Tom's opening, which is something that De Palma's, the start of his films are always so fascinating.
They're curveballs.
Right. He doesn't want, he talks about this in one of the interviews on the Criterion with Noah Baumbach, right. Who's also putting out a documentary this year on De Palma. But where De Palma says, like, it bores him so much when directors just have that, you know, that scene of a car driving up to like a house or something, although The Shining does it really well. But yeah, I mean, most openings of movies that are kind of establishing shots of like the environment they're going to be in and all that sort of thing. But they're not very it's not like something that pulls you in immediately like his movies are. Like the opening of this, the Peeping Tom's thing with it's Margot Kidder, right? As a blind woman in a locker room.
The opening of Sisters, we see Margot Kidder walk in, and she's blind. It's obvious that she's blind. She walks into the male dressing room.
Yeah.
And she starts undressing, and like these guys are looking at her like,
well, one guy. It's just one guy.
One guy's looking at her like, what's going on? Like, should I tell her? Whatever. And then, you know, this one guy eventually comes up and tells her that she's in the male dressing room, right?
It pauses because it's like part of a game show.
Yeah, we find out it's part of a game show.
It's a candid camera thing, and then the contestants have to guess whether he's going to, you know, he's going to sit there and watch her or tell her or just leave.
Yeah.
And he just leaves.
Yeah. So, and then Margot Kidder's character is an actress / model, and she was playing the part of this blind woman on this game show. And that's another classic De Palma thing where he starts the movie off, and then you think it's like Blowout. The opening of Blowout is this like first-person point of view slasher film where this guy's like going through this like sorority with all these girls and
this big long
Steadicam shot where like girl and a guy are fighting over here. There's a couple having sex over here, and there's like a knife
masturbating.
There's the arm out with the knife, and then like they get to the shower. And then this woman gives this awful scream, this movie, type of scream. Yeah. And we find out that we're watching these guys watching an edit of a horror movie they're making.
Nice.
Yeah, sorry to spoil it for you. That's funny. Every one of his films, I mean, Body Double has
Body Double is the same thing, yeah.
With another
very
movie
similar, another
made,
movie set, yeah.
But it's like fascinating just how he uses... how
and
he
all three
films.
Deal with media.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're watching something, and it turns out you're watching something that other people are watching.
Yeah. And watching stuff is very...
Voyeurism
is probably the biggest trademark of a De Palma film is people
comes from
spying
Hitchcock.
And
well,
and
also,
secreting.
He spied on his father having an affair and filmed it back years, you know, in the 60s or whatever. And,
so he might have issues.
Well, voyeurism is definitely something that runs... at the core of all of his pure cinema De Palma films, and he does it in such a way that he takes it further. Like we've kind of said, I mean, he does the things that like Hitchcock probably wanted to do but couldn't get away with.
Yeah, that's what Tarantino said. Tarantino said, "Sure, Brian De Palma is accused of ripping off Hitchcock, but he said Brian De Palma is what Hitchcock wanted to do. He just." In the 1940s and 50s, he just couldn't get away with half the stuff that De Palma can get away with in the 70s and 80s and 90s.
And it wasn't like Hitchcock's last few films like going more and
Frenzy,
more to
in particular.
Perverse direction,
I think Frenzy is the only one that has like a female nudity in it.
Is there a rape scene? It's been a long time since I saw Frenzy, but...
And then Family Plot is... almost a comedy.
That's the last one, right?
Yeah, that was his last one.
Well, there's a lot of comedy in De Palma, too. The way that he deals with violence. The couch, even the couch scene was supposed to be much longer. He had a 6-minute long tracking shot, like Max Ophuls style, where it would keep returning to the couch and you would see the blood spot getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he just couldn't figure out a way to pull it off. Mm-hmm. With the cameras couldn't get low enough to really show the blood spot. Yeah. So he had to abandon. I mean, there's a lot of things he wanted to do with this film. And he just didn't have the money. He wanted to hire Sidney Poitier as the actor and kill him off, like have somebody with a bigger name.
I don't think that would have worked. Sidney Poitier, he was a good performer, but he's kind of severe. He's kind of like a statue.
Yeah. He's not a
living statue, you know.
Not as low-key as that role.
I never really felt like comfortable around watching like this guy is so likable.
Yeah.
This guy is so like just a nice guy, likable guy, guy you'd want to hang out with, and it makes it so much more tragic when he gets killed off. You're like, man, I really like that guy.
Phillip's a good
guy. This film also has William Finley in it, which was he played the other guy with who gets a bruise on his head. Who helped clean up the crime.
Oh, yeah, he's Animal of the Paradise.
William Finley is in a bunch of De Palma movies as like the other guy. I think he was just De Palma's friend who De Palma kind of threw a bone to. So he just put him in a lot of movies. His last movie, I believe, was The Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
Where he's in it for about 2 minutes, and he plays a pretty significant part in a 2-minute role, you know. But for De Palma fans like me, you see, it's Bill Finley, like it's him. There he is. It's like it's kind of like when you watch a Hitchcock movie and you see Hitchcock. Oh, there he is.
Yeah,
you know, there's Bill Finley.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if that actor was a little bit of a stand-in for De Palma instead of De Palma being in front of the camera.
De Palma is also technically in the Black Dahlia because there's scenes in the Black Dahlia of the girl who becomes the Black Dahlia. There's scenes of her auditioning for a film. Mm. So we see the audition, which is the camera, almost like a first-person point of view shot with her auditioning, and the director giving her direction is Brian De Palma, giving her direction, asking her questions about, why do you do this? What do you want to accomplish? That's my Brian De Palma impression.
That's pretty good.
So De Palma does have a cameo in one of his own movies. Yeah. I think that's the only one that I can think of, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the early stuff as well. I know that the early stuff was more he was influenced by Godard and the French New Wave.
Yeah.
And he kind of moved into more the Hitchcock Godard, because those movies were much more loose, and he wanted to get more tight and really work on his – he knew kind of that he was still developing as a filmmaker and that he had some weaknesses. And he thought, you know, he wanted to be in a tighter structure and really work with a stylistic kind of approach and using like Hitchcock – you know, kind of a style and themes, and he basically stuck with that for a good portion of his
career. Lucas and I noticed that we work on projects and we're like, one of the main things we were developing is like tightening up, cutting the fat, making things happen at like a faster rate, you know.
Yeah
Having more event, you know.
Even the dream sequence here, and he was really influenced by Polanski's, which I just Rosemary's Baby, the dream sequence there, which I know some people think maybe is over the top, but I love how it's very ambiguous and you're not sure did it really happen or not. And that's what he wanted to do.
I will admit to have laughed
sequence.
At the dream sequence in Rosemary's Baby the first time I saw it.
This is really happening.
Yeah, right.
That line. Yeah, it's just like that line is so cheesy the way Mia Farrow delivers it.
See that movie all day than Exorcist.
I think the dream sequence.
Loved it over Exorcist.
Absolutely. I think the dream sequence in Sisters is closer to like Polanski's Compulsion.
Yeah. Repulsion.
Repulsion. Sorry. Compulsion is a different movie that's also very good. But Repulsion. Roman Polanski's Repulsion.
Catherine Deneuve. Yeah.
Compulsion, though, is a very good movie starring Orson Welles about the Leopold and Loeb murders.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I haven't seen that in a long time.
Very good.
Compulsion.
But Repulsion is a classic. Repulsion. Definitely. No question about it.
Repulsion.
But he also uses the dream sequence to get across exposition in a way that is not just like telling you blah, 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 blah.
True.
And it's exposition at the very end of the movie, which is also fun, I think.
I think that 20-minute stretch is probably some of the strangest things, strangest thing De Palma ever did.
Certainly. It certainly is.
Yeah.
It doesn't get much stranger than the dream sequence.
There's stuff, weird stuff in Body Double, definitely. But Blowout's a little more straightforward, I think, but still. Trying to think.
De Palma's made entire movies out of dream sequences, but that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. Well, there's such an element, like Argento and him are really like going, it seems to me like they're both very influenced by each other, especially as you get later in the 70s and early 80s.
And kind of a sidebar, the Brian De Palma's films always have amazing trailers. Go on YouTube, look at Brian De Palma's trailers. It's like
we'll actually play the trailer at the beginning of the show.
It's like the perfect like VHS style like trailer before
you won't see it. It'll just be audio.
Yeah, I know, but you know, if anyone does go on YouTube or something and watch them, it's like you've seen these trailers like at the beginning of all the VHS movies you used to watch as a kid. And it's so like sleazy and they perfectly describe what the movie is.
Did he cut his trailers? Do you know?
I don't know if he specifically did the edits first.
I don't think that was very common.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, it's not. I know Paul Thomas Anderson does it now.
PTA does. The trailer for Femme Fatale in particular, Brian De Palma's Femme Fatale, they show pretty much the entire movie in fast motion, and they said, you just watched Femme Fatale. And it was like, go to the theater to see why or something. You know, it's like the entire movie is in like 30 seconds and you know, they do like the chipmunk kind of thing, and it's really original and awesome.
That's awesome. I might watch that movie tonight. I think something
or just the trailer.
I think something important to talk about is that he emerges out of that same school as Scorsese, Lucas, Spielberg, Coppola, Friedkin, but never really had the kind of success they did. I think Carrie had a lot of success, but then, you know, The Fury and Dressed to Kill was pretty big, but he never had the same success. He was never taken as seriously, and basically, by the time of Femme Fatale, he's in Europe making this movie that he probably wanted to make using Hollywood money. But
I feel like, I might be completely wrong, but I feel like De Palma took more chances than the other directors you named, aside from maybe Friedkin.
Yeah, Freak. I mean, I haven't seen Cruising, but he was involved. He was involved.
Yeah, De Palma was supposed to direct Cruising, but he lost the rights to it, and then he kind of made Dress to Kill instead.
I don't know if I can watch Cruising.
It's a good movie. It's weird, but it's a good movie.
I'm sure it's a good movie.
Yeah, I've been trying to track it down.
I've heard it's a good movie, but it's just like...
The Sorcerer, though. Ooh.
Yeah.
I love it.
But, I really think De Palma kind of... Out of those guys, he has like the most specific voice in his films because he takes more chances, and his films often were unsuccessful because of it. But artistically, he and probably then Scorsese, like when you see films directed by those guys, you know they're directed by those guys.
I think maybe it's because De Palma's stories are not always...
They're mainstream.
They're like, sleazy thrillers, kind of. That's kind of what he loves, voyeuristic. Yeah.
But I saw a William Friedkin film that was made recently that's kind of got that. It was one of the most messed up things I've seen in a long time.
Is it Bug or Killer Joe?
Killer Joe.
Yeah. That was like one of his last ones.
That was written by
an old
Tracy
director
Letts.
Making a film that feels like a young director made it.
Killer Joe is... I love Killer Joe. I got...
I've never seen it.
I went to see Tracy Letts, who wrote the play Killer Joe, because Killer Joe's originally a play.
I knew that, yeah.
I think he wrote the screenplay also. I got to meet him in New York City, and I had him sign my DVD and my my copy of the play for it, and I was talking to him about it for like 5 minutes. It was just so cool. And it was right when the movie had come out on DVD. Friedkin also did Bug. I don't know if you've seen Bug. It's also based on a play. I was in a production of that a couple years ago, and that easily could have been directed by Brian De Palma. It's a weird, creepy movie that you guys should definitely cover on a podcast.
I mean, I'm definitely my interest in Friedkin has peaked with seeing Killer Joe.
Yeah. Check out Bug. Check out Bug. It's awesome.
I heard about that years ago, but I never checked it out.
It was kind of the promotion for Bug kind of misled people.
That's why I had a feeling about it. I was like, it sounds like, what? Why would I care? Like, I heard the premise, and I was like, that doesn't sound very interesting, and people keep saying this is really good.
They kind of promoted it like, you remember, like, there was like a long stretch where it was like, what's this monster that's killing everyone?
Yeah.
Like, those kind of movies.
Don't show the monster.
They kind
of
promoted it like that. It is not at all like that. It is not at all.
Oh, I know it's more psychological.
Oh, it's all psychological. The whole thing is psychological.
Something I just wanted to... Because when I was watching Sisters again, it struck me that this felt very kind of raw, the way that like Cronenberg's early films, like Rabid, Shivers, like where he's just finding his what he really wants to cover, talk about like, you know, his body horror, kind of his genre that he's going to then explore for most of his career. And I think that's really interesting to look at those two directors in a similar time period, kind of, well, I guess De Palma's earlier. But still developing kind of
Sisters in particular, kind of, like you said earlier, it has like an exploitation feel to it. And I think it's because there aren't any major actors attached to it.
Yeah.
So the audience doesn't feel safe. You know, like when you see this person in the movie, you know, oh, well, they're going to survive the whole movie, so I don't have to worry about them. But when you don't know any of the actors, really, like Margot Kidder wasn't really famous at this point.
Right. She would go on to play Lois Lane
in the first Superman.
And Amityville Horror, which is a film I really liked as a teenager.
Charles Durning, who's another actor that people would recognize as in Sisters. But he, again, wasn't really well known. He was kind of known. He had made Serpico. Not Serpico. Dog Day Afternoon. It was going to come out in like 2 years after Sisters. So he would become kind of a... bigger actor, but at this time he was kind of just one of those bit players, really. But because you don't know any of these actors, you just didn't feel safe. You know, like, it's not like, oh, Clint Eastwood's in this movie, so he's going to survive all the way. John Wayne, he's not going to die. So
unless you're watching The Shootist.
Unless you're watching The Shootist.
Yeah. In which John Wayne died, and John Wayne died.
Yeah. And there's another one, that old guy from Hateful Eight.
Oh, Bruce Dern.
Bruce Dern is the first person to, I think, murder John Wayne. He shot him in the back in one movie. And Bruce Dern said he was kind of blacklisted a little bit because he was known as the guy who killed John Wayne in a movie.
I wish if there any change I would have made to Hateful Eight, it would have been that Bruce Dern's character got to live longer and do more than just sit in a chair.
I got to meet him a couple years ago.
Amazing actor. Have you seen, what's it called? Where the one where he's trying to like get his, he's got like a sweepstakes ticket.
Oh, in Nebraska.
Nebraska, yes.
Yeah. I liked it.
He's in a lot of great exploitation films of the 70s, Walter Hill movies, and things that you could definitely cover on this podcast.
I was an extra in a movie that they shot upstate New York called Love Orchard. Now it's called Fighting for Freedom. It's not a good movie, but he was in it, and so am I. So
good people.
The scene I was in, I played like a news cameraman, and we were like rushing up to this illegal illegal immigrants that had come into the country, and they were kind of staying with Bruce Dern's family. And Bruce Dern, like, we run up to them, like, what are you doing here? When are you going to da-da-da? And Bruce Dern comes out of this trailer, and he goes, get off of my lawn. Yeah, I need all of you out of here now. And that was supposed to be the scene. And then the news camera people, like, go away. And then he would improvise, like, as we were going, he's like, go pet a goat. Go do this. And the director had to come up to me like, Bruce, we don't need that. Stop. Like, but he would just keep doing it. It was so fun. He was just such a crotchety old man. It was great.
I'm really waiting for...
You got to be told
for...
to get off the lawn by Bruce Dern.
I did. It was excellent.
Is it, like, intimidating? Like, because he's such a powerful performer.
He's just so old. Like, he was frail. Like, he had old man walk where it was, like, his walk was, like, oh, yeah. 18 different, like, hitches. Like,
It's amazing that he's still performing as well as he is at his age.
And he's kind of had a career resurgence.
Oh, yeah. definitely.
I think it all started...
Nebraska,
but really, as a crotchety old man.
Yeah. He was in the TV show, the HBO show Big Love.
That's probably where it really started.
Yeah, that might have been where his first wave of his career resurgence came up. And then Nebraska, he got nominated for an Oscar. Yeah. A lot of people thought he was going to win.
I wish he had won. I almost cried.
I can't remember who else was nominated, but I did enjoy that movie. Yeah.
Well, De Palma's probably never been nominated for... much of anything.
De Palma has he's never been nominated for any Oscars.
Where does he go from here? I mean, he's pretty old himself.
He's in production or pre-production. He's going to make a movie about the Penn State scandal.
Oh, that doesn't sound too exciting.
With Al Pacino's attached to play.
I have heard that to play going Joe Paterno. For years.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like something I would be that excited to watch.
It seems more of like the Hollywood De Palma route. Yeah. You know, but
maybe he gets money and makes one last great, you know, pure cinema De Palma movie. That's my hope.
Well, that's what Passion was.
Well, Passion
out.
Is really good. I'm looking forward to it. I have the Blu-ray.
It's De Palma. You know, calling it really good is.
I mean, can you call any of these movies really
don't
good?
Don't disappoint Matt.
If you like De Palma, it's really good.
Yeah,
because it is Passion is to De Palma as like Tree of Life is to Terrence Malick, where it's just like them doing their own thing and like this is what I do, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I prefer Days of Heaven or Badlands.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I didn't like Tree of Life. So.
Yeah, Tree of Life was overrated. But, yeah.
What?
What did you guys... I mean, Lucas, was this the first De Palma movie you saw?
Probably not.
Other than Scarface.
Have you seen anything like Mission Impossible?
Oh, I saw Carrie before.
Mission Impossible?
Mission to Mars, my wife's favorite
I have not seen any of the Mission Impossible movies.
Ooh. Oh, wow. Ooh. I saw this one in the theater, but I don't remember it. I have a copy. I got to watch it again.
Even Mission Impossible has some De Palma touches to it.
Yeah, I'm sure
nice.
With the camera, I would imagine like some crazy...
Slow motion's another big De Palma thing, kind of violent scenes in slow motion.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of when he... Oh, he does it in Blowout toward the end.
Do you know if, De Palma is, like, more popular in another country than he is here? Because there's a whole thing with, like, John Carpenter is, like, considered a great director in France, and he's considered a B-movie director in America.
I think France and Germany like De Palma more than we do because De Palma is very much style over substance. And a lot of French tastes and German tastes sometimes fall into that.
Yeah,
kind of...
I mean, like, I'm thinking about those films from those countries, and they're always, like, crazy visual.
Yeah.
Or
Italian,
they're always,
too.
Like, insane plots and stuff.
I mean, Argento is that way. I find a lot of similarities, actually, between the two of them.
Well, that's why a few of De Palma's movies take place in Europe. Yeah. Is because that's where he's kind of more accepted.
An Obsession, I haven't seen it, but it feels like it could be... almost like one of those European films. But then it has a score that...
So,
is it rejected score? It's not the rejected score of Vertigo, but it's like reworking Vertigo's... Oh, no.
I'm not sure.
I was reading about that. But.
So if, like, you know, I'm just making, like, crazy visual movies, I should just release them in festivals in Europe.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's probably not a bad idea. Why not?
But I think...
I mean, market's getting bigger for American movies.
I think filmmakers are very influenced by De Palma, though. I think...
yes, a lot of the newer guys, especially.
Yeah, right. I mean, probably Nicholas Van Reft, you know, he's got the Neon Demon trailer I was watching. Yeah, I was watching that trailer the other day, and I was like, wow, okay, this is... There's something De Palma-esque about it. And I'm sure... I mean, I think De Palma actually has had a resurgence as of late. I think if you go online, there's so many different sites that are retrospectives of De Palma's career, re-looking at these movies that critics had kind of, shadow over in the
80s. Has he come back and done any like director commentaries or special features for his old
films? He's never done a director commentary.
He's
but,
on Criterion interviews with Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, there's a
really good
Noah Baumbach has a hour and a half long documentary coming out about De Palma's career, which I almost got to see when I went to the New York Film Festival last year, but it was sold out and I was so upset. But
there's also that conversation I posted the other day, which I haven't watched yet.
He's done a couple interviews, which some of them are on YouTube and some of them you can't really find. But he hasn't sat down and done a director's commentary yet, which is really upsetting because I'd love to hear his commentary for like Body Double or, you know, one of his kind of sleazier movies.
That would be great. And Body Double needs to be released by Criterion. I mean, right now, I think you just have Dress to Kill and
Sisters.
Blowout. And Sisters has never been put out in Blu-ray yet, so it'd probably be remastered. But those are those like there's a 40-minute conversation between Noah Baumbach and De Palma that's fascinating on Blowout, where he talks a lot about the Kennedy assassination and the things that were really
I actually have a thing where I might disagree with you. Sisters, I think almost like keeping it lower res is better.
Almost helps.
Yes. The Arrow, I know Arrow, which is
you don't want to clean it up
great,
too much.
They're like almost they're like B-movie Criterion in Europe, and they put out a version that, and it looks like pristine, like 4K restoration.
Going with Dave's point about kind of releasing these certain movies on Blu-ray, that doesn't always help. I'm a big fan of the film JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK.
I fucking love it.
And that film, the way it's edited, it kind of uses like documentary-type footage that's supposed to look grainy. So when I bought it on Blu-ray, I was like, it's not really a big change because there's supposed to be like grit on the film. Like it's supposed to look this way. Like the scenes that are like the more natural, you know, this is real life. And then it kind of flashes back to this new scene or like alternate angle of certain shots. It's supposed to look like home video, you know, like that isn't really helped by Blu-ray because it's supposed to look bad.
Yeah. Certain films are supposed to have a certain look and
other films are new variants.
I always find it interesting when like silent films are released on Blu-ray. Like Buster Keaton's The General is on Blu-ray, and it looks amazing, but it's like, this is a silent film from 1926, you know? It's like...
Yeah, I heard there's going to be a restoration
of Caligari. All the Chaplin movies.
Yeah?
Oh, really?
That'll be
4K Caligari.
Yeah. Oh, I posted that. I shared that on your Facebook.
Yes, you did?
That's right, yeah.
But that movie is so, you know, weird, and it almost the blurry quality is like almost gives it that sense of the dream, like... And you might be able to see more on Blu-ray and 4K restoration for sure, but that having this blurry quality and you know, what did I'm not sure what's happening over in this corner. It's just like dark shapes moving.
I mean, I think it would be incredible to see that Sisters in the movie theater. Any of his films, really. I mean, I saw Black Dahlia in the theater, but I would love to see any of these movies on something larger than my
television
screen.
I don't hate the Black Dahlia.
I don't remember it as well.
It should be better. I remember.
There's supposed to be a longer cut that audiences said worked better.
Yeah. Yeah. Black Dahlia as is kind of all over the place. It's a little – it's not a great movie, but it's not – it has like a 5 on IMDb, and it's it's better than that, I think. Like technically, it's a great-looking film.
The problem is that it was like one of those things where it was so – scenes that were so serious and the audience started to laugh out loud.
Yeah. It's because the acting wasn't – tremendous in that, and the casting was weird with Hilary Swank playing like the sexy femme fatale. Like that's not exactly Hilary Swank's forte.
I feel like some of De Palma's casting choices are kind of, and there are moments where you're almost cringing with the dialogue and just kind of cheesiness level, especially in like the early 80s. Some of the even the classic films.
I've always
Dressed to Kill has moments definitely.
Sean Connery was supposed to be in Dressed to Kill
as
the Michael Caine character, but something happened where he had to drop out. He was filming like Zardoz, or he was filming one of these.
Just watched that recently.
He was filming one of these weird Sean Connery movies, and Michael Caine filled in for him. But Sean Connery was so heartbroken that eventually, when De Palma offered him Untouchables, he was like, "Oh, thank God, because I want to work with this guy."
Well, I mean, the actors loved working with him. He was. Yeah. Well, he was sleeping with all the women, but you can't blame him.
And I really loved working with him.
He really worked well with the actors. I mean, Travolta and
Travolta's in a couple of De Palma's movies,
Carrie and Blowout, I don't know what.
I think that's it.
But yeah, still a few.
And he got the best out of Travolta. I mean, Travolta, you know, whatever you have to say about him, gives decent performances in those movies. And
so the one I hear is the really bad one is Bonfire of the Vanities.
You know, that it's not a poorly made film. it's just people had such high expectations because it had such a big budget, and the book that it's based on was a huge hit, and it's just not good. And the casting is weird.
Yeah.
Like, Bruce Willis was cast in it. Like he was kind of like, oh, he's a big star. Put him in this movie. And De Palma didn't want him. De Palma wanted John Lithgow, who's another Brian De Palma guy.
Yeah, he's in he's the
Raising Cane.
So think about the differences between John Lithgow and Bruce Willis.
The big difference.
The part is more suitable for John Lithgow. So that movie was just kind of like screwed from the beginning. And I feel like De Palma did the best he could with what he had. It just, you know, a film that's starring Tom Hanks and Bruce Willis and Morgan Freeman and a movie based on a book that was a huge hit with a lot of money thrown at it, with Brian De Palma's name attached to it, who was just coming off, you know, The Untouchables and the big movies.
Casualties of War.
Casualties of War had come out. I think that was his previous film. It just didn't make money, so it's gone down as a terrible movie. But I watched it not too long ago, and it's not terrible.
Yeah.
It's just not good.
I mean, Mission to Mars is kind of like that, I feel.
Yeah.
It's not terrible, but it's not really... It's not like...
I can't remember if I saw Mission to Mars or Red Planet.
Yeah. And then there's Redacted, which I heard is pretty bad, too.
Redacted is awful.
Yeah.
I think Redacted is De Palma's... I've heard
that's probably his worst.
That's De Palma's worst movie.
So...
All right, so Sisters. It's a pretty straightforward plot, at least in the first... There's like the first 45 minutes where you're following a really straightforward plot.
30 minutes until Philip gets killed.
Philip's only an hour and a half.
There's this game show, and it was a Canada camera thing, and afterwards the...
Weird African... That was kind of strange.
The African room?
Yeah. Every time I watch that, I'm just like, wow, that wouldn't be done today.
Why are we here?
But it is a cool-looking set. Yeah.
They had the... She's the actress who plays this prank on him, and he shows up on the game show. And is like, yeah, you got me. And then they go out afterwards. They go on a date, and they go back to her place, but there's this weird guy hanging around, and it's like, what's that about? Oh, it's her ex-husband. It's just like Lair's getting revealed about her. There's something wrong with her, and she has a sister.
Well, they do show that scar too, that weird Cronenberg scar. Oh yes, that was, which is the first sign that there's something.
Yeah, she has a big scar on her hip.
Talk about the effective use of the music. It's like the what's his name and her and Margaret
Philip.
Yeah, Philip and Margot Kidder's character are making out on the couch, and it's like this love scene, but the music is just like.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, this is creeping me out.
It's almost like a theremin type of David Arquette still thing going on.
Yeah, and he's lifting her dress up. You get more and more of her leg, and then you get up to her thigh, and you start to see the scar.
This big, big, huge scar that takes up like her entire hip, where she would have been attached to her Siamese twin sister.
Yeah, long story short, she was a Siamese twin who was separated. And really long story short, the Siamese twin... died, and she took on the personality, so she had a dual personality, and the other personality would kill people.
Yeah,
when she had sex or sexual thoughts or whatever, that's when she kind of
which just kind of goes back to like cat people.
And, yeah, it's kind of true. I'm sure De Palma liked Val Lewton films, probably.
I'm sure, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and so
that's like the first. Hey. That's only like the first. That's like the first 30 minutes right there, really.
Yeah.
And we don't really know they're Siamese twins until later, but not until the hour mark.
I think. Lucas actually was like, I didn't like the twist after. And I'm
I didn't like the twist. I said, I saw it coming. I was just like, yeah.
I don't see it as a twist. I think it's the audience is in on it. Like earlier, you were talking about the Hitchcock thing where it's like, let the audience know or the bomb is in the car.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the twist as much as like just the execution, the way he does it.
Right. It's not about that twist. It's like that twist is sort of like revealed halfway through.
Yeah.
Oh, it's revealed at the hour. It's revealed when she goes to she goes to and watches the tape on the Siamese twins, I think. Yeah. That's like about the hour mark. What's her name? Grace Collier? Yeah. Grace Kelly, I'm sure.
Collier.
Yeah.
Grace Kelly, that was a princess.
Well, no, I know, but I'm sure that was
going back to Hitchcock.
Yeah, that's why I said that's probably the name was probably.
What
are you doing, dude?
I'm just hanging out with my microphone here.
don't touch it because it makes noise.
Did you want to?
Man, dude.
You want to finish the rest of the plot or are we just going to?
Well, yeah.
Let the audience. Because this movie's
She murders the guy who makes love with and. which is very surreal. Like, one of my favorite shots in any movie is, like, after he gets stabbed and she's, like, sitting up in the bed just looking, and he's crawling away.
Yeah, and she's just, like, flipping out. Like,
and she's just looking at it. It's like...
She's, like, jerking what herself is back and forth.
Like. It's, like, there's this this image of, like, him crawling that way, her looking around in the foreground. It's something about that. It's just like so, with especially Bernard
it's
Human's
super visceral,
music.
And it's also it's again it's Cronenberg.
And has any blood ever been redder in the history of film?
The Crayola really? Red. I love the Crayola red blood in old '70s films.
Like, did you ever hear the Scorsese story about the ending of Taxi Driver?
Oh yeah, with the blood.
There's Scorsese. You've seen Taxi Driver,
yes.
And the end with the shootout is extremely bloody. De Niro has blood all over him at the end of it, and the MPAA or whatever board told him, like, this blood is just too gross, like, we need you to, like, mute it, it's too red. So they went back and they kind of toned the color down, and he said it made the film so much more dreary and, like, it really, like, helped the film and it made it more violent or something like that, or to him more, it made it more violent, and he said, like, it just made the movie so much better.
Yeah.
I love that when censors actually accidentally make things worse.
Yeah.
Which happens so often.
And they're fine with it?
Yeah, because you did what they asked you to. So they're like, you've pleased them.
Yeah.
Why would they complain?
So eventually Grace kind of goes to this insane asylum.
Grace sees the murder. You were talking about with the split screen and everything.
She's a reporter.
You could only do this in a movie, that split screen. It's like movie is the only media that really allows this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe if you had a play, but even then you couldn't do the kind of shots they were doing.
I love the way that they introduce Grace's character with the kind of – they show her, like – she has, like, clippings of all of her, like, news articles, like, on her wall, and they show them, like, one at a time saying, you know, so-and-so-and-so by Grace Collier. So, like, the audience knows –
you know she's a journalist.
She's an investigative journalist.
Right. And the cops don't want – they're not crazy about her.
She always has her nose and everything.
Right. So, and you get that – they get it across very quickly.
Yeah, no words are spoken when you kind of realize what she's all about.
Yeah.
And it doesn't show her as a journalist in a positive light.
No.
It shows her as being very biased.
She's very nosy and
yeah. Yeah, it's like you kind of don't like Grace. And there's this thing, the point on that is like when it's clear that the cops don't like her and she's like, I saw a murder, and she's like pestering them and like threatening them with like, I'll write an article about you if you don't do what I say. And, you know, we're going to go up there because I saw a murder. And they're like, all right. And the cops go up there and they don't –
the body's been cleaned up by this point.
The body's been cleaned up, so they don't see anything. So there's no evidence. So there's like, there's no body. We have no sign that any crime has been committed. And she's still yelling, right? And so they just kind of get out of there.
Most of this is all split screen too. Let's just say that. A lot of what he just said was in split screen with the cleanup.
Mm-hmm. And then she's like on a phone later with a friend who's never shown, someone she's like consulting as to what to do about it. And she's like, I saw a black man murdered, and those racist cops don't want to even care to investigate.
She's
it's
talking
like
to her
race
mother,
had nothing to do with it.
She's talking to her mother, right?
Maybe it's her.
In the car?
I thought it was either a mother or a friend. You never see who she's talking to. But it might be her mother who shows up at the end of the film.
Yeah. And that was actually Jennifer Salt's mother, the actress who played. Because I guess she was an actress herself.
Yeah. The last 20 or 30 minutes are quite bizarre.
Yeah,
I mean, when she goes into that house and that woman is screaming with the telephone.
Yeah,
and
there's like this like safe haven for people. Yeah. Like, it's kind of like an insane asylum. It's not really an asylum. It's just like a
house. It's a house where they're trying to like
house for
readjust
the mentally ill,
mentally ill people. But then
she sneaks in. And she kind of gets caught by like the orderly who thinks she's
one of the crazy
patient there. And when she says, "No, I don't go here. My name is
Bill
Grace."
Finley just jumps in and says, "Oh yeah, you know, she came in yesterday.
She admitted
she's so and so, and she's really this person." And
so the orderly is kind of they give her the shot, which knocks her out, and then
you have a crazy dream.
And then that's when the crazy dream sequence happens.
I think that like that scene where it's like, "Oh, you're crazy, and we're gonna give you drugs and hold you in this room against your will." I think that's like a universal fear.
Oh, it absolutely
that
is.
People aren't going to believe what you're saying.
Yeah.
And are going to treat you like crazy, or
again,
that you might be going crazy.
Again, that's a Rosemary's Baby thing, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
And
probably commenting on the 70s, women's rights. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go too far down that road. But
right. Well, I think it's more of just like a universal thing.
Yeah.
And
absolutely. Because, you know, crazy people often don't know they're crazy. And I'm sure a lot of them say, well, I'm not crazy. It's like, you know, alcoholics never say they're an alcoholic, even if they are. They just, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. Sure, you're not, you know.
I love that dream sequence. I love the way that it goes into like black and white, and it's a mixture of like the television footage and kind of, and all these people are coming up and flashing pictures, and it's just kind of like a Fellini kind of.
And you see the camera crew following the evil scientist.
Oh, you're right. It is absolutely like a Fellini shot.
And then also you see twins. All those people are twins that are watching everything. You see, I noticed, like, rewatching it, I'm like, okay, that's...
And then a lot of...
twins? Those are twins? They're twins?
There's a scene where a big, like, butcher cleaver is, like, being passed from one person to another. Yeah. And a lot of those people are, like, minor characters from previously in the film.
Yeah.
And, like Charles Durning, who plays the private investigator she hires, like, he eventually is given the knife, and he kind of holds it over his face, so we see that it's him... And it's done in, like, super slow motion, like, super stylized, with, like, everyone's eyes are, like, huge and everything.
Yeah,
like
and the idea in the dream sequence that that's surgery is so surreal that he just takes a cleaver and, I will cut you in half. Yeah. Like,
and, like, he lifts it up over his head and then slams it down, and then she, like, wakes up screaming at that point.
It's like the mythical knot.
And the music, going back to Bernard Herrmann's music during that dream sequence is just brilliant.
And it's very, I feel a strong Psycho vibe from that music.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Strong Psycho vibe from the movie.
Big Psycho vibe, And you, and by the end, you kind of feel for the character, even though you're not crazy about the journalist throughout. But when she's like hypnotized or mind warped,
when she's in peril,
saying there is no body, when they're like, well, okay, now we have a case and everything. And she's like, there was no body. There is no body.
They keep flashing to her eye, and then you're seeing from her point of view.
Yeah.
And you really, at that point in the film, it's not has nothing to do with who she is as a character, and you've been annoyed with her. You are her.
Yeah.
And you are, again, totally subjective.
It's the first person point of view shot with William Finley in her face about 2 inches from the camera, and it has that kind of like fisheye lens. Where everything's kind of distorted.
And he's, she's drugged up and he's hypnotizing her.
Essentially hypnotizing her. You know, you never saw, there never was a murder, you know.
There is no body.
There is no body. And then when she comes out of the dream, she's hypnotized. So that's what she says when the cop asks her.
Yeah.
And then I love this movie.
I the last shot's great too. That's very Hitchcockian. But you get the detective now. He's in Canada and he's found the couch and he's staring. He's on the telephone.
It's not over.
No, but it's also another voyeuristic.
Still on the job.
The movie starts out with the voyeuristic stuff with the peeping toms and ends with the voyeuristic kind of the cop now on the telephone pole.
Yeah, the private detective is still following. He's like, I'm going to follow that couch.
And the last shot, though, feels very classic movie kind
of
last shot.
It kind of reminds me of, what is it, The Pit and the Pendulum, where the last shot is the guy's like eyes in the door, like he's still down there or something. I think it's The Pit and the Pendulum.
It's one of those ones.
One of those Corman
where, like, the last shot is like, oh, yeah, that guy's still down there. Like,
That is Pit and the Pendulum.
Like, everything's happened and, like, the movie's over.
Yeah.
But then, wait, what about that guy? No. And then the movie ends.
And the door is like, they're never going to go down there. Like,
it's like you have this train station or stop in the middle of Canada, and there's just this cow next to the couch. And why is there a cow there? It's
a free roaming cow.
It's like, oh, the couch, and it's just, and the shot lingers and it's pulling back. And I just started going, what the fuck is a cow doing there?
That's probably his strangest ending, too. I mean, I'm trying to think. But again, he has very strong endings. He's very good with beginnings and endings.
Blowout has a great ending.
Blowout
but
has
let's
a fantastic
not,
ending.
Let's not spoil that.
We're not gonna spoil. We might do an
the
episode
of
that. Who knows?
The police don't know where the body is, and they can't prosecute that unless they find out where the body is.
And the woman who was accusing her of murdering is now hypnotized and has no seemingly no recollection of what
happened.
But the
private detective knows where the body is, and he's following it, but he's not doing anything but observing it because he's... wants to catch the person who he's like, there's somebody on the end who's going to pick up the couch and I want to catch him.
Yeah.
It's like he's totally lost sight of what the priorities are here.
It's just a tremendous movie.
It was even better the second time through. I mean, it is really, it may be his best film. I mean, it's up there.
And when you think of the movies he made before Sisters, they're not like this. Like, this is easily his most mature film up to this point in his career. Like, his first couple films were like Greetings and The Wedding Party, which are, I described it to Dave earlier as like De Palma does The Monkees, where it's like...
And these, I just cringed at that.
They're these weird, like, almost like hippie-ish style, weird, almost music video films, and like a very young Robert De Niro is in them.
Yeah, those are his first movies, I think.
Yeah. But then he made a movie called Hi Mom in 1970, which stars Robert De Niro as the main guy. And there's some De Palma. There's the definitely big voyeuristic vibe in it. And there's this one sequence called Be Black Baby, which is kind of a exhibitionist racism kind of performance art, which is, it's very hard to explain, but if you love or even like De Palma, like, it's pure De Palma, and it's shot in black and white.
Which one? That was
that's High Mom.
Yeah, but Greetings has the stuff with the JFK assassination.
Yeah, Greetings has like a JFK conspiracy guy in it.
Conspiracy, like.
But then he made, you know, he made Dionysus in 69, which is just kind of an experimental film. Then he made Get to Know Your Rabbit with Orson Welles in 1972, which was taken away from him, I think, halfway through. So I think his name is on it, but it's not really a Brian De Palma film. And then he made Sisters, which is just kind of a huge leap forward.
And that's the start of his Hitchcockian kind of exploring Hitchcock. And
yeah, but are you sure losing the film wasn't because Orson Welles was involved? Because if Orson Welles is involved with the project, it's bound to go off the rails at some point.
You're absolutely right. That's probably it. But then you think of his movies right after Sisters. He made Phantom of the Paradise the next year, and then he made Carrie 2 years later, which was the biggest movie for him at that point. Because
whole movies I've never seen. That's really a hard one to find. Voice. But then, and then after that, he does The Fury.
He did Obsession the same year as Carrie.
Obsession's... Yeah,
The Fury was 78, and then Home Movies,
and then it goes into like Dressed to Kill, Body Double,
Scarface was in the middle of there somewhere. he made a comedy called Wise Guys in 1985 with Joe Piscopo and Danny DeVito.
I've heard it's terrible.
It's not good.
Yeah,
it's silly, but it's not good. But then,
talk about almost silly in this, but like again with the voyeuristic tension. The detective, when he's investigating the apartment, and she's just watching out the window, and it's pure rear window.
It's pure rear window where he's trying to find evidence in the newly cleaned apartment where he doesn't know what to look for or anything like that. And she's just kind of like across the street trying to tell him what to find, and he can't find it.
And then they come back to the apartment, and she's like, oh no, you got to get out of there. So she calls the phone as a signal to him.
Yeah. Body Double has a lot of rear window also.
Yeah.
But I don't want to get into his other films too much right now.
It's all the voyeurism. It's all the voyeurism. I love
Brian De Palma. They blend together in a lot of ways, but the voyeurism is just kind of...
Absolutely one of my favorite directors, Brian De Palma.
Yeah, you have to check out those...
Well, thank you for listening to the Brian De Palma podcast.
We should explore some more. Like, I mean, Phantom of the Paradise is very different to be his next film.
Phantom of the Paradise is more of like a Rocky Horror Picture Show movie than anything else.
Yeah.
Just with De Palma in it.
Bill Finley as the main guy.
So. Yeah. And Paul Williams.
Paul Williams as
the singer-songwriter Paul Williams, who did the theme for The Love Boat. He plays like the evil villain of the film. Really weird.
And he wrote all the music, too.
Yeah, the music's actually good.
And it's really pretty cool.
The music might have been nominated for an Oscar or something, or maybe a Golden Globe even.
Yeah, I'd like to get that soundtrack also.
So there's one last thing about Sisters that it fascinates me is that Margot Kidder had bipolar disorder, and she was manic, and she had an episode where she had to, I believe it was in the mid-90s, where she had to go and get treatment.
She was found like pulling her teeth out of her head or something like that?
Or like her fillings had come out. She was found like in an alley with homeless people, and her fillings had like come out somehow.
Jesus.
She
was really messed up. But I hear she's been fine ever since. And it's unfortunate that, I think the media labeled her as a nut and she was just sick. But, I mean, bipolar disorder, it's like, and here she's playing a split personality, mental institution.
De Palma wrote this film for Margot Kidder and Jennifer Salt, the two lead actresses.
Yeah, and it's like, I can't. Like, did Brian De Palma know she
were
was Bible
tendencies of some kind or something? I don't know. But yeah, the film was written with those two in mind. I guess those two were roommates as kind of struggling actresses in the early 70s. And De Palma said, "Here's a script. I want you two to be in it."
Weird. And like we talked about Grace when she gets drugged and she has the dream sequence that is right at the end of the film and purely expositional. But it's also the investigator gets this becomes the dead sister in the dream sequence, and it becomes very subjective. It's almost like the thing you were investigating, trying to find out about. You're not telling the story, you are the story. Yeah. And, you know, she becomes, in these dream sequences, the dead sister, the Siamese twin. And it's probably the most, you know, throwing dramatic narrative element. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is going on? Like, I had to explain to Lucas, no, she's not actually the sister.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's an impression that can be taken away on, especially almost, first viewing.
It's almost like a quantum leap where you, like, assume the body of this person.
Yeah.
In this dream scene.
But it's like, that there is something. It's like now that, you know, because, you know, when she's being hypnotized, it's so point of view, subjective, like you're seeing from her point of view. And then this dream sequence where she's become the character. It's like you become her, she becomes this character. Yeah.
And then a lot of the minor characters we've seen earlier in the film are also involved in the dream scene because...
And you were there and you've been there.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
too. Scarecrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oz is weird enough, but... Don't want to go to this place.
Well, Jellyheads, this has been an episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In.
Very special episode.
Very special with our mega guests.
Yeah!
Mega show.
No U-Turns Mega Show 2016.
Woo!
Oh. No, that's an LCA thing. And we're not doing that here.
We've been your hosts, Lucas and...
Dave, with your special mega guests...
Evan Jones.
Matthew Allegretti.
Do you want people to follow you anywhere there, Jones? Good?
No.
No, good? Is there anything you want to say there, Matt?
Evan, just keep on writing these best directors, best visual films, because I thought I've seen a lot of movies, but you're introducing me to all kinds of cool
stuff. I
think
I've only got two more to go for the visual films, I think.
You're costing me a fortune, though.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, get that up on our website. If you enjoyed this episode, may I suggest you go to our website at psychotoyfish.com to find that and other podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and the podcast app Stitcher. Please rate and review. It really does help our show. If you're a fan, you want to help spread the madness, give us a like at facebook.com/psychotoyfish or follow us on Twitter at Jellycast.
Bye.
Good night, gentle listeners.
Keep it psycho.
Oh, I love that quote.
Which one?
The crazy cleaning lady.
The phone?
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
The girl with the phone?
Who wants to say it?
Lucas, you need to say it.
Because you're a crazy woman.
Yeah, I'm a crazy woman. Okay.
You're the closest one.
Crazy woman.
I'm the closest we're going to get to a crazy woman.
Yep.
All right.
It's the name of your new autobiography.